Welcome to another episode of the Entangling Web3 podcast. Now, two topics that crop up time and time again on this show and in Web3 at large are privacy and scalability. So one technology that actually tackles both of these issues at the same time is zero-knowledge proofs, or zero-knowledge proof systems, ZKPs, if you've heard of it, referred to as that before. So we did touch briefly on how zero-knowledge proofs are being used to improve blockchain scalability in our recent episode about layer two systems. But today we're going to go one step further and do a kind of full deep dive on how ZKPs work and how they actually do apply to Web3. So to tackle this question, of course, I'm joined as ever by my co-host, Alec. Are you excited for this one, Alec?
Yeah, like you say, this is very fundamental. I think we've talked about it a lot. And when we talk about some of the issues with Web3 at large, like you said there, when we had our Polygon episode with Colin Butler, he touched on this stuff as a real kind of method for actually getting around a lot of the issues that we see with kind of mainstream cryptocurrency adoption and, you know, other utility use cases as well. So I'm quite excited to go through this. We've kind of hinted at it and kind of talked a bit at the very high level stuff and basically black boxed it. So now it's on us to try and actually open that black box and try and explain what's going on the inside, which should be interesting.
Yeah, exactly. It is, as you said, it's such a core piece of infrastructure to Web3 now. And it's not just a Web3 topic. It's been around for a lot longer, as we'll go into. But at a very high level, just taking this as a glance, because it is very technical, we don't want to get too bogged down in the weeds. But zero-knowledge proofs, they essentially just allow you to prove a statement. So something like the statement, I am over 18. They allow you to prove a statement like that is true without giving away any other information other than the fact that it is true, right? So without giving away what your actual age is. And that's where this term zero knowledge comes from. It leaks zero knowledge about the statement other than the fact that it's true or false. So that's kind of at a high level what they are. Now, there's a lot of deep technical detail that goes into that, but it's interesting to us because it is used for scaling, for privacy preserving ID in Web3. So yeah, it's definitely one we should go through in detail, I think.
Yeah, we touched on this quite a lot in the digital identity, the two episodes we did on that as like a kind of a core component benefit of actually taking identities into the digital space. So it's, I think that's the example that most people use, is that I am over 18 without actually giving you my, you know, my date of birth. I think another really core one that's kind of semi-obvious in a way is DCDSA signature schemes, how we actually send Bitcoin and unlock and lock Bitcoins to people's addresses. And that's a completely fundamental to the entire Bitcoin ecosystem, but that's one that's maybe less obvious in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it goes back to that idea of like privacy preserving computation. It's generally pops up as a theme anywhere where you want to preserve privacy in any blockchain system. There's lots of actual blockchains now that have popped up purely based on zero knowledge tech, because you want to do things like confidential transactions or private smart contracts and things like that, which we'll get into a bit later.
Yeah, so should we jump into where this all originated? I mean, I wasn't born, neither were you, Jack. We're both two youngsters in the space. But I think it was back in 1985 by someone called Goldwasser, Mikhaly and Rakoff. I just butchered those pronunciations, or?
Yeah, it's close enough. Goldwasser, I think, Mikhaly and Rakoff. And Mikhaly is a really interesting one because he is actually the brains behind Algorand, if you've heard of that blockchain. It's kind of around the top 50. I think it was actually significantly higher before. One of my first introductions to the space was looking at Algorand and what that does. So yeah, these are some really heavyweight people in cryptography. These guys have come up with some of the most fundamental protocols that we've used, one of them being zero knowledge systems. So in 1985, their paper really introduced this concept as a thing that we now use today.
And I think it kind of makes a lot of sense. Like, at a high level, you have a secret, and typically to prove knowledge of that secret, you have to show someone the secret. And as soon as you share the secret, it's no longer a secret, right? So I think really fundamentally, this paper back in 1985 kind of talked to a method of allowing a party, in this case, we call them the prover, to prove something to another party, the verifier, that actually shows they know the secret without revealing the secret itself. And obviously that's us describing it without going into the deep mathematics that was in that paper, but that's kind of fundamentally what it was about and what zero knowledge proof is about at a high level.
Yeah, whenever we talk about it, those are the two key parties you always have to bear in mind, a prover and a verifier. So someone's always trying to prove that statement, like me going to a bar or something, trying to prove you are over 18. The verifier being the barman who wants to check you are over 18 so I can sell you alcohol for something like that. So you always have those two parties, and then zero knowledge proofs are this very new way to allow you to prove that statement, right? As you said, you don't want to give away all that information. You don't want to have to show your passport because that shows your home address or your place of birth and things like that, which aren't necessary to revealing what your actual age is.
Yeah, and in that original paper, I think some of the things they talk quite generally about what we just mentioned there, proving identity without disclosing sensitive information. Another thing they talked about, which is really interesting, is the idea around secure voting systems. So obviously there's a whole kind of area around your provability of voting. I mean, in the UK, we have like ballots and paper-based voting, which is, you know, mind-boggling in the digital age to do that. And I was like, okay, why don't we just move that into the digital age? It seems quite obvious to just do online voting. And someone came back to me and said, well, as soon as I do that, there's a provability thing there, where if you have some digital receipt for your voting, for example, it can be very easy to blackmail someone, say, okay, prove that you didn't vote for this party or you did vote for this party, or else I'm going to take your car or something like that. So it's actually really interesting. It's not as simple in, you know, the modern age to just take paper-based voting systems into the digital age without having all of these issues around privacy preservation, but also proof of authentic voting. That's another use case they talked about in that original paper.
Yeah, voting is always one of the hardest use cases to get right. And I've heard a lot of people saying, you know, digital voting, there's always going to be issues with it. But ZKPs are seen as one of the most robust ways to achieve it now, whether or not there may be other problems associated with it. But again, just taking a step back. So in 1985, we have this idea of how can I reveal that some secret, I have a secret, I possess a secret, I know some secret value, I have a statement that I can prove is true without telling you anything else about that. That's taking us back 30 odd years now. These technologies developed, I would say, quite slowly through the 90s, 2000s. It really wasn't until Bitcoin and the rise of blockchain, as we so often say, that some of these cryptographic tools have now been completely accelerated into the mainstream consciousness. And so much money, I'd say it must be something like 99% of the money that's been thrown at this technology, at the cryptography, the research to develop them, make them more efficient, more practical. So much of that has actually happened in the last decade, maybe even the last 5 or 6 years. So that's really the Web3 movement has been the spearhead for why ZKPs are now becoming much more practical, much more feasible to use for everyday applications.
Yeah, like you say, that's the most obvious one that I'm aware of and what most people will be aware of. I think it, without going too much into the details of like private public key pairs and how I can effectively say, you know, I am the private key owner of this public key address and then sign transactions based on that. That's the most fundamental and popular method of ZKP. I think that's kind of somewhat easy to understand because it's all mathematical. I think I struggle myself when you abstract it to when you have like actual content details, like real world practical examples, like how do you prove I am over 18 related to my date of birth? I mean, that again is kind of a numerical one, right? That's easy to understand. Okay, if they have a threshold where the date today minus the date of birth is over 18, then fairly easy to work that out mathematically without revealing anything potentially. I think it gets more complicated when it's like prove that they're allowed to drive this car, for example, or prove that they have this insurance. I think that's where in my mind, like, how do you actually extrapolate something like that back to the mathematics that underpins it?
Yeah, and the mathematics that underpins it is very complicated. It's very hard to understand and parse. And for those simpler use cases like the identity verification or proof of age, those are some of the simpler examples, I would say. And now we're seeing Web3, this technology and the underlying proof system with zero knowledge, that's now being applied to much, much more complex statements, really. It's being applied to things like prove that the last 10,000 Ethereum transactions have been executed correctly, because that's how zero knowledge proofs are being applied to scaling solutions, right? For things like Ethereum, it's pretty much the most popular angle now for scaling solutions. And those are much more complex systems, which we'll get into. But we heard from Colin Butler as well, $1 billion been invested in zero knowledge projects by Polygon, right? That's just one example of how much investment and capital has flown into researching these. So it makes sense that they're being used, but loads of that is being driven by the demand for the scalability of blockchain.
Yeah, and like you say, the two motivations for this at a high level are the privacy and the scalability. Like the privacy stuff is kind of easy to explain because I have a secret and I'm not revealing that secret, but I'm proving to a verifying party that I know that secret without revealing it. So that kind of makes sense. And the scalability aspect, you can talk about that from different angles. In the Bitcoin example, well, the point is you can generate this fairly low computational signature that is very difficult to fraud, very easy to verify. So I imagine that's one of the reasons why it makes Bitcoin is so scalable. It enables the UTXO model to, you know, independently create signatures and verify signatures where different parties can't double spend something like that. For example, you don't need a central custodian managing everything in that example.
Yeah, and like, you know, at a high level, you can clearly see how digital signatures are effectively a form of zero knowledge proof. That's not the form that we tend to talk about in blockchain at the minute, but it gives you a simple example. So to kind of move this on and make it a bit more tangible, shall we go through another example that doesn't involve blockchain, doesn't involve Web3, to actually explain what these zero knowledge proofs are and how they work at a high level?
Go on, Jack. I know you want to give your colored ball example, so let's do it.
Yeah, we'll see if I can do this. But so this is, it's called the colorblind friend puzzle, and this is one of the most popular ways to explain it. So this is by no means coming from me. I haven't come up with this. This is a typical 101 for how zero knowledge proofs work. Essentially, think you've got two friends, so say me and Alec, and one of us is colorblind. So in this scenario, I'll be the prover and Alec will be the verifier. So Alec is my colorblind friend for this example, the verifier. So let's say I've got two balls. One of them is colored red, one of them is colored green. So I've got two balls.
You should get those checked out.
I've got one red ball, one green ball. And my statement that I want to prove is that these two balls are different colors, because you, Alec, you can't tell that because you're colorblind, right? So to you, the balls look exactly the same. To me, they're different colors. So how do I prove the statement to you that these are actually different colors in practice? What I can do is I can ask you to hold them and put them behind your back. So I'll give you to the two balls, you put them behind your back, and then you can decide to switch them. So again, you're the verifier. You're going to switch or not switch those balls. You're going to show them back to me, and then I'm going to tell you if you've switched them or not. Okay. So because I can see the color difference, I should be able to correctly identify if you switched them or not. And you'll know if you switched them or not because you've done the physical movement of switching them. Okay. That's a very simple kind of challenge response. You challenge me to identify if it's changed, and then I respond to tell you it has or hasn't. Now, I could get this right with probability of half. Okay. So how do we make sure you're convinced by this statement? Is then you would repeat that many, many times, so switching or not switching. And then I'll be able to guess right every single time. And the probability of me doing that just by random chance is vanishingly small if you do many, many of these challenge response back and forth. So at a high level, that's how it works. And you can be convinced, even though you're colorblind, that these are actually different color balls.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly good example of how this stuff works. Like when I first heard this explanation, I didn't actually comprehend that the verifier who is colorblind actually is keeping tabs on the balls as well, right? So like they have one in each hand. At the start, they can't see there's any difference between them. And as I'm putting them behind my back, I am tracking where I'm going left hand, right, so I can keep tabs and always reference you saying red or green to my original starting point to know if it's always the same. But yeah, I think that's quite an interesting example. It kind of brushes over a lot of the more tricky stuff, but yeah, it kind of does make sense.
Yeah, I like it as an example because it tells you about the three core properties that every zero knowledge proof should have, right? So the first of those is what we call completeness. So basically means if my statement is true, i.e. that the balls are different colors, then as an honest verifier, you should be convinced by an honest prover, right? So if we're both acting honestly and the statement's true, you should know, which is true, right? So if the balls are actually different colors, then I should be able to identify you've switched it every single time. So that satisfies the property of completeness for this example.
So I guess on the other side, then what you were saying before is you've got this property of soundness, right? So if the statement is false, then it's really difficult for the prover to convince the honest verifier that it is true, except with like quite a small probability. So you were saying there that if you're guessing each time, for example, in the ball example, you've got a 50% chance of guessing it right each time. But if you do it 1,000 times, it's very unlikely that we're just guessing that you'd be able to get it right every single time, right?
Yeah, it's like 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5. 10,000 times over, however many times you do it. So that probability becomes so small that there's no way that I could convince you that if the statement is false, basically. And then you also have the third property, which is the one in the name, zero knowledge. So if the statement is true, then you as the verifier shouldn't learn anything else about the balls or about the system, about the problem we're talking about, other than the fact that the statement is true or the fact that the balls have been changed, right? So it doesn't tell you whether the ball in your left hand is red or the ball in the right hand is red, right? It doesn't tell you which of the balls are in each of the hands. All you know is that they are different colors, which is exactly this property of zero knowledge. It doesn't leak anything else about the system to you.
Yeah, I feel sorry for this colorblind friend who's holding your balls. But so yeah, I guess this example that you talk about, there's a lot of interactivity between, you know, the verifier and the prover, which when we think about handing over ID or a university degree or something like that, you want instant verification. You want something that's quick and easy, one step process, right? So I think one, the example that you just gave is very interactive. And when, you know, we're talking about verifying credentials in the example of I'm over 18, I hand over my driver's license to prove that, or I want to verify a credential like my university degree, what we want is instant verification. We don't really want that back and forth that you were talking about where I have to do multiple rounds and multiple iterations of me proving that this ball's red and this ball's green. So then we come to this final characteristic, which is interactivity. So these zero knowledge proofs can either be interactive or non-interactive. So the example that Jack gave there with the colorblind friend and the balls is an interactive ZKP where the prover and the verifier are basically engaging in this back and forth, this communication online. That might not be particularly useful because it's quite tedious. There's a lot of effort involved in that. So a more popular kind of method that I guess is emerging is quite useful for Web3 is the idea of a non-interactive ZKP where the proof can be generated and verified really without direct interaction between the prover and the verifier. I guess an example of this would be the ECDSA signatures and transactions in Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's why they're much more powerful. You can do them offline. You can do them asynchronously. So we don't have to be together and online in the same room or something to do this. You can do it at different times, especially when you're trying to do something like for a scaling solution where you want the network to verify something about what's just happened off chain. So that's exactly this kind of asynchronous communication, asynchronous proving system that you want, right? So yeah, non-interactive zero knowledge proofs, they're very much the big flavor of zero knowledge proofs that are being worked on fervently in the Web3 world at the minute.
Okay. And I guess there must be like a typical standard of how ZKPs work. You know, there are many different flavors and techniques. Do you want to just talk us through that?
Yeah. So again, we are going to be generalizing here, as you said, because there are so many different versions. But in general, you have a kind of five-stage process. These stages are, I'll just kind of summarize them. So you have a setup phase. So that's when the prover and the verifier, they agree on what the kind of problem statement is, what the parameters are. So, you know, that's the establishing the two balls, the red and green ball in our previous example. Then the second phase is what we call a commitment. So the prover then has to commit to certain kind of choices or values, this kind of secret value without revealing them. And that involves a kind of, sometimes can involve committing to multiple things depending on the system you're using. But you basically have this commitment around the statement you're trying to prove. Then you get into this third and fourth step, which is that challenge response. So in the interactive proof scenario, this is where the verifier is going to send that challenge to the prover. So you're going to ask me to identify whether you've switched the balls, right? You as the verifier. So that's the challenge. Then step four being the response. I as the prover then calculate or just give you my response to that challenge based on my knowledge of this secret information, right? So my knowledge that the balls are actually different colors. And then finally, you have a verification step. So this is where you as the verifier then verifies my response is correct. So you have to verify, did I switch the balls behind my back? And in some cases, you'll end up repeating that many, many times in the simplest case. But there are, again, much more complex ways of achieving this mathematically now.
Okay, that makes sense. So now you kind of talked about the general setup and how, you know, ZKPs are typically done across the board. Should we go to some popular examples and popular, I guess, styles of ZKP? I think one of the ones that I've been hearing a lot in the space recently is this SNARK, this term SNARK, which is maybe everywhere, which it stands for Succinct Non-Interactive Argument of Knowledge. So it's quite nice they got that down to something a bit more catchy than that. I think, you know, just to go through some of the high levels of this, SNARKs effectively enable a verifier to quickly check the proof without actually executing the procedure itself. So some of the high level characteristics of it is it uses cryptography. It relies on, you know, elliptic curve cryptography, which is similar to what we use in Bitcoin transactions as an ECDSA setup. It has to have a trusted setup phase where the initial parameters are generated, similar to what we were describing in the Balls example with a colorblind friend. And that phase is critical, because if the setup is compromised, then the security of the entire system could be at risk. Is there anything else on these that you want to mention?
No, I think that's probably one of the crucial aspects, is this trusted setup phase. And that's one of the issues that some people might have with SNARK systems. There's a lot of work actually being done to distribute that initial setup phase. There's things called distributed key generation, where you don't just have a single point of failure for that trust point there. You distribute that amongst maybe a network of different people, but it is still a feature of that system. But again, it does have the benefits, as you said, of it, the proof size is quite small and you can verify it very fast. The other major kind of flavor of zero knowledge proofs that we're seeing a lot in Web3 are similarly, I mean, people in cryptography and Web3, they just love their acronyms and their naming conventions. So the other one is called a Stark, as in Tony Stark, not named after him, I don't think. It stands for scalable, transparent arguments of knowledge, right? So the emphasis being more on the transparency here. So they're similar to SNARKs, but they don't actually require this trusted setup phase, which is a huge benefit, right? So they are more secure against certain attacks on the system that might be related to that single point of failure.
Yeah, and I saw that instead of using elliptic curve cryptography like SNARKs do, they tend to use hash functions, right? Which apparently might make them more resistant to quantum attacks, which I don't really understand. I guess hash functions are advancing more quickly. You can actually scale up the hash functions more quickly than elliptic curves. Is that the reasoning there?
Well, yeah, I think this is for another episode on quantum security. But basically, the attacks that would be possible with a quantum computer, so there are many attacks that might apply to elliptic curve systems that don't apply to hash functions, basically as an artifact of how those two systems work, right? So there aren't algorithms that quantum computer could do that would efficiently attack hash functions in the same way they would attack ECDSA. So that is a good benefit, actually, of the Stark systems.
Yeah, I guess one of the drawbacks of Starks versus Snarks is they actually have larger proof sizes and longer verification times compared to Snarks, which can obviously be a drawback. But yeah, like you said, one of the benefits there is the absence of that trusted setup phase increases the transparency and security, which makes them, you know, more appealing for a lot of applications where trust is actually a critical concern.
Yeah, and what I think you're seeing here is just like we said with the blockchain scalability problem, right? The blockchain scalability trilemma, where you have three different competing properties, and if you have two, you probably don't have the third. You have this similar thing with zero knowledge systems, where it might be efficient to prove but inefficient to verify, or it might have large proof sizes but be efficient to verify, and likewise. So you with one system you get two of the three properties normally, with another you get a different two of three. On that note, you have a third flavor, which I think is worth mentioning, is they're called bulletproofs. So this is, again, a non-interactive zero knowledge proof. So you can do things asynchronously, and partly why they're so popular. They also don't require a trusted setup. So that's really good. And they're actually really much more efficient than Snarks and Starks. But again, there's always a drawback. They do require a lot more computational effort to actually verify the proof. So they're more scalable in some ways, but less scalable in others.
Okay. And so just to summarize those three flavors that we've been through, you have ZK Snarks, which have the smaller proof sizes and fast verification times, but require this trusted setup phase, which can pose potential security risks. You've got ZK Starks, which eliminate the need for this initial trusted setup phase and are quantum resistant, which we'll talk about maybe in a later episode, but they have larger proofs and longer verification times. And then the final flavor is bulletproofs, which provide a balance of not needing the trusted setup, relatively small proof sizes, not as small as ZK Snarks, but are well suited for applications, you know, that need both privacy and transparency.
Lovely summary. And it's worth just noting before we move on, but all three of those flavors are much, much more complex than we were talking about with the colored balls example. There's so much mathematics that goes behind that is very hard to understand. But the basic principles of zero knowledge proofs still apply, and they will have those properties that we mentioned at the start. I think that covers what they are in zero knowledge proofs and roughly how they work at a high level. Should we talk a bit more about the applications of them, and like specifically in Web3, what are they actually being used for?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. We've talked about these two big motivators, which are privacy and scalability. It might be worth just like diving into them and actually talking about specific examples of how that works. Like if we start off with privacy, I gave the example of confidential voting. It allows a user to vote potentially without revealing their choice, but you're ensuring privacy of the voter, but also quite importantly, that the vote is legitimate. And that's quite a difficult balance that we kind of talked about. It's actually really tricky to implement in the digital space.
Yeah, exactly. And this idea of confidential transactions has been around for quite a long time with things like Monero and doing almost encrypted transfers. Zcash is another example. So that's a cryptocurrency that uses ZKPs to actually enable this private transacting. And you have it in all sorts of smart contract systems now where you're trying to not have all that computation on chain, not trying to give away all the information about your transactions and pushing that to layer two networks, like, you know, also like Lightning. There's a lot of zero knowledge work going on there to kind of provide also different functionality to Bitcoin, like being able to do smart contracts that verify using these zero knowledge proofs that you can't necessarily do with the base scripting level language.
It's really interesting with the Lightning Network. Like when you go on their website and all the pages and people talking about it, I thought that it was primarily just for scalability, you know, bundle and have all these transactions being like handled off chain and then being submitted on chain to get around like high transaction fees and the speeds and all this kind of stuff. But actually one of their main reasons for existing is actually the privacy thing. They say that, you know, we actually think that it's, you know, bad for a lot of applications to have one wallet that's linked to so many transactions and being able to track everything and have everything actually being linked to one another and having this transparency. So yeah, it's actually a big tenet of why they exist is the fact that they want to actually increase privacy and have a bit more abstraction, which is quite interesting. And one of the final, I think, things that fit into this is the idea of selected disclosure, which we talked about in detail across the podcast, but particularly in the digital identity episodes. The idea of, like we always say, proving that you're over a certain age without needing to give all the information, like here's my date of birth, for example. And I think that's something that makes sense to a lot of people. They can understand the applications of that, but it's actually quite tricky to understand how the mathematics relates to that maybe.
Yeah, and I think where zero knowledge proofs fit in here, right, is that they take the idea of selective disclosure that we've talked about before, so not showing your passport to prove your age because you don't want to show your home address. It takes it one step further and it won't even show your age now. It will just prove a statement about your age. So it's almost like the most granular version of selected disclosure where you give away the least information, right? By definition, zero knowledge, you leak zero knowledge about your identity other than this very specific statement that you're trying to prove. So that kind of deals with the privacy element. The other element we've talked about also is scalability. And as we said in the layer two episode, zero knowledge proofs are being used extensively in things called zero knowledge rollups, right? So these are the layer two scaling solution that is used to kind of aggregate multiple transactions and batch multiple transactions up into one single main chain transaction. So many off-chain transactions that are rolled up into a single on-chain transaction to minimize how much you pay in fees, how much network congestion there is. And zero knowledge proofs are, as you'd expect, the kind of foundational cryptographic tool that's being used in these ZK rollups. So they're actually allowing you to prove the statement that all these transactions have been executed using, for example, the Ethereum virtual machine. And all these transactions in the batch work and are valid and follow the protocol rules, right? And that's been one of the really key developments in the last few years is creating zero knowledge systems that are EVM compatible, which has been a really big challenge, but they've kind of just starting to crack that now. And you've got some notable examples like ZK Sync. That's one of these layer two scaling solutions. There's been about $500 million of Ethereum locked into that scaling solution. And that's the most popular layer two that uses zero knowledge proof, right?
Yeah, like it's an interesting area. Again, it's kind of so black box. I don't really understand how it works, but it's interesting that people think it does work. And there's a lot of money going into that space. And like we keep saying, the main chains right now, they're kind of the cost of actually transacting day to day for normal retail investors and the time it takes to actually get these transactions through is just ridiculous. So if we're not going to change the actual protocols that determining how these main chains are working, then we need to have layer two scaling solutions, side chains, whatever it is. And a lot of them, like you say, are underpinned with ZK Tech right now. So I think we kind of talked about those two umbrella characteristics. maybe we should go through some specific examples that I think will make this feel a bit more material. Identity verification is obviously one. We don't need to keep talking about proving you're over 18 plus, but this applies to a lot of other areas as well. You can imagine like basic KYC. If you're gambling, for example, you need to prove that you're allowed to go to this gambling agent. You need to prove the access control with enhancing privacy and security. And I think gambling is quite a good example because it's a bit of a maybe a non-desirable area that people want to do but don't necessarily want to have anything linked back to them for blackmail purposes, whatever. But I think KYC quite generally is going to benefit hugely from this space.
Yeah, definitely. And you've had some quite notable examples of, again, to mention Polygon ID system is something that's come out in the last couple of years that uses an open source zero knowledge protocol called the IDEN3 protocol. And this is just becoming much more popular because of that application of selective disclosure. It makes a perfect sense as the technology you should use for identity systems, and we're seeing that more and more. And it gives you that kind of more granular access control to which data you're going to share, and it also helps you to kind of safeguard against the anti-SIBL systems.
So what's an anti-SIBL system?
So yeah, anti-SIBL is interesting. It's part of a lot of the cryptography that went into Bitcoin and things, but a SIBL is basically where you can have many different identities controlled by a single entity. That's like a SIBL attack. I forget where the actual name for SIBL came along from, but essentially, what you can use zero knowledge for is then to prove uniqueness of an identity, right? So prove that you are a unique kind of human entity, but without, again, revealing that identifying information, which is really important if you're participating in like a governance protocol or a decentralized autonomous organization, for example. You might want to participate in that, which is often a global thing. You're participating with people across the world that you don't know. You don't necessarily want to give any identifiable information away other than this almost like a proof of liveness, right? Proof that you are a real human person. So yeah, it's a really good application of ZKPs, I think.
So another big one is supply chain transparency. We've talked about this is one of the key applications of blockchain. I think one of the best examples we've given about the amount that Walmart saved in authenticating goods, taking like good origin kind of authentication from 7 days down to 3 minutes, and like reducing disputes on those goods by like 95% or something like this. So the idea of ZKPs allowing supply chain participants, quite importantly, that are different independent actors all trying to work together, which is obviously a perfect example of how Bitcoin and blockchain should be used to prove, you know, authenticity, origin, and the journey of products without revealing sensitive business information. This is quite an important thing when we think about supply chains. Like a lot of reluctance to supply chains or companies actually putting their supply chains on public blockchains is the idea of them revealing sensitive information to competitors potentially. Even if I'm not, as Walmart, not saying, you know, this good is on this part of the supply chain at this time and it costs this much, there's actually a way for people to aggregate a lot of the data, say, okay, well, Walmart's doing peak amount of transactions at this time. This is when they get the most customers through potentially. So the idea of using ZKP to get around this, to preserve privacy, to potentially abstract things off chain so that people can't relate that to Walmart, is quite a powerful thing for the supply chain traceability aspect.
That's obviously, I think, also one of the main reasons why lots of these kind of supply chain entities have in the past been just using private implementations of the blockchain, right? Because they haven't really had that, especially like 2016, 2017, when Hyperledger was taking off. A lot of the zero knowledge tech wasn't really there to support this. So they kind of had very little choice but to go and use private blockchains. But now that the zero knowledge proof technology has advanced so much, now it's a great solution for achieving exactly what you said, this kind of hybrid model between using a public blockchain but maintaining the privacy over the data and for all the stakeholders in that supply chain, which is really important. Another one that I think is interesting is on gaming, and also for like NFTs and gaming. But I think when I think of gaming, there's obviously different flavors, but I think when you talk about gambling-based games in particular, is one that I'm interested in, I think, for the technology, because you have a natural kind of information asymmetry in games, right? In gambling games, because you don't want to give away information to your competitors, your opponents in that game, right? If you're playing a game of poker, for example. So again, there's a clear application here of zero knowledge where you can prove that maybe you had the winning hand in a game of poker without revealing what that hand was. That kind of satisfies the conditions you need for an in-person game of poker typically. And this has always been a really big challenge to solve, is how do you do distributed online poker in a robust way? So I think that's a really good application. Also for kind of provably fair random number generation, getting randomness is actually really hard. If you're not just going to flick a coin, 100 times, especially in a distributed environment, again, where you can't necessarily trust everyone else who you're playing with, then using zero knowledge proofs is a really interesting way to start injecting randomness in a way that you can then prove later is fair and hasn't been gamed by someone else in the system, for example.
Yeah, and I think a really good one related to this stuff is the idea of rates of success, right? And this applies to gamings in loot boxes where they say you've got a 1 in 10 chance or 1 in 1,000 chance of winning this amount of money, or, you know, general gambling as well, where you go to the lottery and it says this is the chance of winning. Like, how do you prove that without actually referencing all the individual's data that bought, say, access or a ticket or a lottery ticket to these events? And ZKP is another great way of doing it. You don't actually reveal any information about the individuals participating in it, but you can prove that the data is authentic in a way, and then actually prove that someone won and link that back to the rates. I think this is quite an important one that's coming into the space. We can also talk about privacy for NFTs. We've talked about your non-fungible tokens really being important for proving ownership and transaction history related to games. It could be how good you are at a certain game, how many times you've played. But it's also important to understand that you don't necessarily want to prove all the information about that and have every single game you've ever played and when on chain. You just want to prove that it is authentic in a certain way. So yeah, there's lots of applications of this stuff. It's quite exciting, but I think it's much more than just proving you're over 18 in the bar like Jack always does.
Yeah, I think that's, again, we're throwing a lot at this today, right? Because it's a hard enough technology to understand, but I think what we've just shown is that there are major use cases for it, and new use cases are coming out every day. Now, there are some kind of implications and concerns you want to think about. I think we should just highlight a few of those kind of before we finish the episode. So for starters, we've highlighted the benefit of privacy, but that also always needs to be weighed against anonymity and the risks you have in anonymous systems, right? So as soon as you have a high degree of privacy that may stray into an anonymous system, then you have risk of abuse of systems. And where we talked about reducing civil attacks in some situations, there may be other places where zero knowledge proofs and adding that level of complete privacy may increase the risk of civil attacks if you can't identify certain information about people. So again, it's a case-by-case basis thing, in my opinion. Like, zero knowledge proofs are a tool, and they're not going to be the kind of golden bullet tool to use all the time for every application. You need to look at what the actual specific needs are. And again, there are so many different flavors. Which zero knowledge proof system you use will be very much kind of use case application dependent, right? Sometimes more information might be needed for transparency. Say it's a KYC process, for example.
Yeah, I think a good phrase that I like here is the idea of secrecy versus privacy, right? Blockchains are, despite what Jamie Dimon says and everyone in the US Senate says, blockchain and Bitcoin is meant to be the most transparent system that's ever existed. But that, and quite importantly, there's privacy there. There's not secrecy. If I send Jack one Bitcoin because we've made it, Jack knows about it, I know about it, in the same way that if I buy something from Amazon, Amazon knows about it and I know about it. The whole world doesn't need to know about that transaction and who we are necessarily. That's privacy. But when we start to get into this realm of ZKP potentially and abstracting everything away, it kind of borders on the, is it secret now? Are we trying to remove any association? Does it become more ambiguous? Like, do we need a bit more transparency there? So I think it's a bit of a blurred area. I'm not saying necessarily that these systems are intended to be fully secret, but it's just something that we should be aware of. And I think related to this stuff, there's also the whole trust paradigm that you've touched on there. Like, we are trying to, we're very much in the space and we're trying to explain how these systems work. And even we're saying, you know, a lot of this stuff is black box. Well, if it's a black box, imagine trying to discuss this stuff in a legislative environment. That's going to be really tricky. How do you prove to people actually this data is cryptographically backed and is authentic? It just opens up a whole world of difficulty in legal terms.
Yeah. And on that topic of trust, right, we said some of these systems have trusted setup, some of them don't. So when you throw that into the mix as well, of essentially there's a degree of trust in the people implementing these protocols. It's similar with blockchains themselves, right? For most people, it's so technical and hard to pass as an individual that you are putting trust that someone else will be verifying that these things are true, that these things are robust, for example. We have the same thing in encryption standards, right? So the encryption protocols we use today, like AES, that is encrypting our web traffic in the browser right now, that stuff was all part of a competition in America, right, with the National Institute of Standards. And we were kind of trusting that they've done all the necessary rigor to prove that these things are secure, because we are, as individuals, aren't doing it. And I think a similar thing applies with zero knowledge. You have to kind of assume a little bit that other people are actually attacking the systems to try and break them. We mentioned that term cryptanalysis before, right? So that it's a profession. People should try and break these crypto systems because we need to know if they are secure. And because it's an early stage technology as well, maybe there are weaknesses that we don't know about yet. There actually have been a few weaknesses in zero knowledge systems exposed in the last couple of years, and we've moved on from them. But it's worth remembering that we're always putting a little bit of trust while they're early technologies.
Yeah, and on that point that you raised there about trust and kind of relying on someone or something, like I say, a lot of these setups, you do have a trusted party in the interactive setups, for example. And I guess a lot of the Bitcoin maxis will be thinking, you know, this Bitcoin's all about decentralization, removing unnecessary intermediaries. But I think that's never going to be the case with absolutely everything. When we talk about digital identity, for example, proving that you are real, authenticating data, you're always going to need some trust provider. I can't say that I have a British passport. I need the British government to say this passport is valid and relates to Alec. So I think, I don't really dive or agree with that statement too much. I think we're always going to need some kind of trusted intermediary for certain use cases. And obviously one of the biggest challenges is the technical barriers. Like we've said that these are incredibly technically complex things, and they are becoming more scalable, cheaper to deploy, more computationally feasible to deploy. But still right now, they are very computationally intense. But hopefully that'll become less so in the future and make the systems more usable for everyday applications.
Yeah, and if there's been one single trend from the last few years, is that these technical barriers to adoption and scaling have been kind of slowly removed every year. So all that investment that's going into the space is improving the efficiency of the protocols, is making proofs more compact. There's people working on reducing the size of these proofs by bytes all the time, and that can make a big difference, especially when you're thinking of millions of transactions a day or billions of transactions a day in the future in Web3. So I think, talking of the future, I think that's going to be one of the big things we see, is that continued march to adoption. Then you have maybe, what else do you see in the future, right? Because I think we also touched on the quantum resistance piece and the fact that people see zero knowledge proofs and especially Stark's implementation as quite a promising solution for how we can maintain privacy in the post-quantum cryptography world. What else do you see being important in the kind of future of the zero knowledge landscape?
The quantum resistance question is really interesting. Like, this is something that a lot of people are saying, is it feasible? Is it not feasible? If it is feasible and it gets deployed in the world, it's going to screw up so much of our security systems, right, across the board. Like, it will completely undermine Bitcoin. So that's a really interesting question. We'll almost certainly do an entire episode about what quantum resistance is and why it's relevant, what quantum computing is and all that kind of stuff. I think that's an important point. I think another important point apart from that and mainstream adoption is regulatory compliance. We love talking about regulation on this show. We talk about GDPR and all the issues that are arising with companies around the world trying to comply with GDPR. But in a world where we can use ZKP, companies don't need to handle the raw data that relates to an individual. So it could help significantly with the GDPR and data maintenance burden. I think that's going to be a huge boon for this industry as well.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to that concept of like pushing data back out to the edges of the network so you don't have to store everything with the large companies. It reduces your risk as an individual. It reduces the risk of the big company for a data breach, right? So I think there's a huge impetus for this technology to be adopted and to continue to be adopted. And on that point, a kind of a final one for me would be the general theme of decentralization, love it or loathe it. I think zero knowledge proofs dovetail into that quite nicely because of that, again, that point of pushing things out to the edge, having distributed identity systems where you can self-manage. And again, not everyone will want to use it, I don't think, in the future, but it will at least give us the option to take more control, take more custody over our data and information if we want to. And if we want to have these kind of higher level of security and privacy in our transactions where appropriate, then I think that will be a big motivation for people to start using this. And there'll be many more use cases that we definitely haven't thought of or covered today going forward. But yeah, I think it's an exciting space and the one that is just impossible to keep track of. It's growing so fast. So let's see where we are in a year's time on it.
And on that bombshell, to summarize, we've covered zero knowledge proofs and technology, how they work at a very high level. We talked about the main reasons that this kind of area is being pushed, that is privacy preservation and scalability for blockchain technologies. We went into a lot of detail on the applications, how this can be used in, you know, day-to-day life, and some of the big challenges that still exist and will continue to exist in the future. And on that, we also talked about the future implications and what it could mean. But yeah, it's quite a comprehensive summary, I hope, at a fairly high level on zero knowledge tech. And thank you for listening wherever you may be, and join us next time as we untangle a little more of Web3. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3, produced by Emma Camilleri.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.